Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer Jennifer Case about her memoir, Sawbill, A Search for Place, in which she weaves autobiography, biography, and artifact to capture the spiritual essence of place.
There is a spirituality to living in a particular location and knowing the particularities of that location well and feeling like you are part of that non-human community as much as the human community that surrounds you. And I guess what you need to do is to find it.
Jennifer Case and her search for Sawbill Lodge on Arts and Letters. Jennifer Case, welcome.
Thank you.
This book is phenomenally written, but it's so complicated. So I thought what we could do is maybe you could just give us a little of the history.
Okay.
And it's such an interesting history because it is about a search for place, mm-hmm. right? So let's just start with the concept of a search for place. Mm-hmm. You search for this place and you write, what really am I looking for? Mm-hmm. And it comes toward the end of the book. What were you looking for?
Well, when I started the project, both the book actually and first became obsessed with Sawbill, because the book follows the research trajectory. So I did actually start writing it well before I even knew what it was I was looking for. But I had left Minnesota, and my family was in the process of leaving Minnesota, and I felt a large sense of loss at the loss of that geographical grounding. And so I was searching for, you know, a strong sense of home that could tie my family together again. And the only physical thing I could think of to cling to was this lodge that my grandparents had run in northeastern Minnesota. And I'd never actually been there because they had to sell it and it was dismantled well before I was born. But my family went up to that area a lot when I was growing up. And somehow I started to think about this lodge as that location that had they hung on to it, had they kept it, my family wouldn't be so dispersed across the United States. And this would have been the location that would bring us all back together and provide that sense of home and family and belonging, even when life seemed to challenge those things.
Tell us about the early history of Sawbill. So this is a lodge mm-hmm. in Minnesota, mm-hmm. and it has quite a history.
Yeah. When lodges were being built in northeastern Minnesota, so this was the 1920s, 1930s, very beginning of the 1940s, it was right when the highway department was suddenly going into that part of Minnesota, which hadn't before been able to easily be reached by tourists or anyone for that matter. When those highways went in, suddenly resorts started going up because it was such a beautiful part of the country and it was a great place for people in the Twin Cities or Chicago or Milwaukee even to go up and have their fishing experience, their outdoors experience. And so this lodge was built around that time period in the 1930s by a family originally from Ohio, so the Argobust family.
So let's hear a little bit from the actual newspaper article about Jean and George Argobust.
This is the story of a man and a woman who are licked to a frazzle by the Great Depression of 30 and 31. Nothing unusual about that, you may say. There were plenty more in the same boat. But there was something unusual about this pair, for while the collapse of their world knocked the wind out of them, with their second wind, they licked the depression. Through sheer grit and stick-to-itiveness, they carved out a new life for themselves in a totally new environment.
I just think this is so fascinating, the way it's written. And
yes.
You're right, and in some ways it is a kind of advertisement for
yes.
the place.
And so begins the story of the Argo busts, a story I can hardly reconcile with what I have read from my other sources. I read with curiosity, with humor, as Vivian Thorpe of the Minneapolis Times Tribune continues in her heightened language to describe the stone-broke Argo busts immediately after George's wife's death and the way their lives eventually intersect with Jean's. They have a really interesting story, and as I learned more, I became more and more fascinated with their story as well. The mother had died in Ohio, and the father had moved. They had five children to Chicago to try and find work in Chicago.
This is during the Depression.
This was during the Great Depression, and that just never worked, so they actually moved to a cabin in Wisconsin for a little bit, but child services were called out on the family, so the father brought them back to Chicago for a little bit. And then the uncle had brought the oldest boy up to northeastern Minnesota and had, you know, this vacation, this fishing experience. And that, for some reason, that trip made that son want to go back up to the area and think that perhaps their family could find work in that part of Minnesota or begin a resort. Then, one afternoon in Chicago, something happened. Just one of those trivial happenings which sometimes determine the fate of men and nations. The younger children had been off visiting a lady they had met, and they liked her so much, and she gave them such a happy time, that Argobus thought he should meet her too. She turned out to be younger than he expected, only in her middle 20s, but he liked her as his children had and the acquaintance grew. Then, one day, Wilson wrote his father like this, "Dad, you're a big goop. What's the use of trying to buck this business game? There's nothing in it. You're just wearing yourself out. Give it up and come up north and make a fresh start." Said Argobus to himself, "I may be nutty, but why not?" He and the kids went over and talked to their new friend, Jean, and she, too, said, "Why not?" Argobus said, "I'd like to have you go along." And once more Jean said, "Why not?" Said Argobus, "All right, let's get married." And Jean said simply, "Okay."
And help us with Jean.
And then Jean is the woman that the father, George Argobus, met in Chicago. And when they decided to go up to northeastern Minnesota, they got married. It was quite advantageous for them because she had come from Cornell University and had a degree in hotel management. So she had the business background and the tourist background that helped them establish this resort. Our second full summer in upstate New York, I discover an old newspaper article about the Argo busts. The newspaper article, originally published on July 29, 1940, in the Minneapolis Times Tribune, is 29th in a series about interesting Minnesotans, and the front page contains two large photographs of Jean and George. Jean stands next to a birch tree, a dappled forest behind her. She wears a striped shirt that puffs at the wrists, tucked just into a dark empire waist skirt with large white buttons. She does not look at the camera, but rather off to the left, past the fold in the newspaper. With her half-smile, full face, high forehead, and hair pulled back in the 1940s style, Jean fills the frame, sturdier and thicker in complexion than one would expect for someone on the front of the paper. She exudes a matronly confidence. She could knock me over if she wanted.
So she's sturdier and thicker in complexion mm-hmm. than one would expect.
She challenged the ideals, I guess. She challenged who I thought she would be, and she challenged who I thought the newspaper would discuss at that time period and who I thought would be successful in running this resort.
Okay, let's hear about George.
On the other side, in the top right, the blonde-haired George stares directly into the camera, smiling wide enough to show off his six top teeth. His brow slightly shadows his eyes.
Morning, morning.
His short blonde hair cowlicks in the front, reminding me of some unnameable character actor, someone who laughs and drinks a little too much, but not enough to become problematic. Knowing what I do about Gene and George, I am surprised to be holding a love story.
Yeah, so it was a love story.
It was.
What did you see as the love story?
Well, in this article, it was all about them falling in love and going up to the North Shore and falling in love with the location itself and their relationship, and their relationship with that place healed them, I guess. According to this article, it healed them and it allowed them to overcome the Great Depression and have this much more solid livelihood.
George, his wife has died, and it seems like they're a good match. And it just so gets to the heart of America at the time.
Yeah.
Like, you can make it on your own.
Yeah.
You can do it. And then the idea of licking the depression, right? Let's get over this depression.
Yeah.
And by depression, I mean the country's depression. And in some ways, possibly, George might have been a bit depressed, too, just with the...
I wouldn't be surprised. He was struggling to find work. His children were able to find work more often in Chicago than he did, yet he was the one responsible of taking care of these five children. So it had to be incredibly hard. And he had moved around a lot, Wisconsin, Chicago, trying different jobs, losing them. So, you know, I can imagine he was trying to find anything he could to provide more stability for his family.
Makes sense. Okay, let's hear some more.
That, Thorpe writes, was how the partnership to lick the depression started. According to Thorpe, Gene called George a hard-hitting sweetheart and the spark plug of this whole enterprise. According to Thorpe herself, Gene is quite a gal.
And it seems to me you're kind of falling in love at the time, too, right?
Yeah, I've just gotten married, started a new life of my own as well, so the parallels were definitely there.
And the people who really make appearances here are your grandmother, your grandfather, your father, your mother, your brother a little bit, and your husband.
Yes.
But what I think is so interesting to me is it seems, and this could be the reading in, but that no one's as nostalgic as you are.
No.
And you want things rooted.
I do. I do want things rooted, and I struggle when they aren't rooted with that reality.
And I guess the reason I ask is because in the book, for me, you're more positioned as Jean than anyone else.
Yes.
That's I'm going back. And Jean's all alone and she goes back and she really, she needs to understand something.
Yeah. I'm really interested in what draws people to that region and made them stay. And that's a question I had for my family too. Why did my family leave? I would never have left, or so I thought, because I loved the area so much, but it didn't seem to have that same kind of pull for my parents or my grandparents because they did leave. And I saw the same thing then happening with the Argo bus where George and all of the kids eventually left the resort.
Right.
But Gene went back. And so why?
Looking back, it's 2020. Our family is scattered to the wind. The past is just a memory. The place we must all go again. Paths were taken and trails were forged. We made our way on different shores. But now knowing I soon forget if things have been different, I'd have no regret. If things have been different, I'd have no regret. If things have been different, I'd have no regret.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to author Jennifer Case talk about her book, Sawbill, A Search for Place. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with author Jennifer Case as she talks about her book, Sawbill, A Search for Place.
Are we there yet? How far to go? Are we there yet? Do you know? Are we there yet? How far to go? Seems forever since we were there. Hard to bear. Saw you crying and you said, let's go. Another chance to hit the open road.
Without money or backing or physical equipment, with nothing but high courage, in 9 years they fought their way to a life happier and fuller of fundamental satisfaction than any they could have found if life had not given them that mighty punch below the belt.
And this idea of 9 years they fought their way to a life happier, what were some of the things that maybe weren't so happy that happened in those 9 years? We can talk about the building of the thing, which was happy but not happy with the ice.
Yeah, I do know, according to the Suns, that there were a lot of setbacks from the bank, from the Forest Service, when they were building, not giving them the license or the permits or putting it off so they'd have to wait another year before they could begin building. And then once they did start building, they needed to find logs, and the particular kind of log wasn't right around the resort, so they had to boat across the lake and find it on the other side, and then they logged the trees, and then they brought them back. But winter came. It was end of October, early November, and winter set in. So there was this moment when they were trying to build the resort or get the logs so that they could build the resort in the spring, where 50 or so logs froze into the lakeshore. Once each tree fell, they topped it, limbed it, and then dragged it to the shore. From a distance, those white and brown logs looked like a pile of matchsticks haphazardly scattered in the dirt. But close up, the magnitude of those 434 logs pulled knees to the ground. George borrowed a fishing boat from Andy Tofty, a member of the township's founding family, and towed 6 or 7 logs at a time the 5.5 miles to the lodge site. The progress was slow. When snow and ice began to fall in November, white trunks still lined the bank. Snow flicked the water like mosquitoes, eventually giving the entire shore an icy top layer. Wilson and the crew pulled their collars up and listened for the chug of the 3-horsepower motor. George hauled 1 load of logs, then told the crew to pack up. The next morning, when Wilson returned to the logs, they had frozen within the ice. At the site, George let the motor die. Snow blew across the lake, whistling through the air with an eerie whine. If the logs remained another night, they'd be stuck all winter. The group unloaded hatchets and picks. For 12 hours straight, they gouged ice from the frozen pine until each of the logs again bobbed like an icy martyr. Then, in trip after trip, they hauled the logs to the other side of the lake and pulled them to the shore. Once they had finally salvaged all of the logs, the men collapsed on the bank as Jean brought out blankets and hot coffee. They were too exhausted to talk, but already they could see it. Sawbill Lodge, up on the hill like a dream. It's a beautiful moment in the story. The ice, the snow, the logs sitting there, the pieces all set for assembly. The story about to unfold and take place. It's enough to make me want to stop my research, to say, here it is, this is the story we must follow. They put in the work. They found a way to make their dreams unfold. Their love for the area, their care for the place, surely is palpable. And in caring for the place, didn't they do what so many families during the Great Depression and so many families today cannot? Didn't they manage to come back together, to create their own community in a place that they loved? Community with the environment and with each other? And yet, maybe it was only in that moment of anticipation that Sawbill seemed perfect, for me and for them. For it is in the opening of the lodge, and its history after, that my expectations for centeredness flounder.
And the line, and in the caring for the place, didn't they manage to come back together?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what you want?
Definitely, yeah.
With your family?
That's what I was searching for.
Yeah, everybody coming together
mm-hmm.
over a dream.
Mm-hmm. In a location where they have a history. So where these memories are rooted in a way that, I guess, allows people to live on and the history to live on, even if those people aren't there.
Are we there yet? Do you know? Are we there yet? How far to go? Are we there yet? Do you know? Are we there yet? How will we know?
So there's this dream of the shining lodge
mm-hmm.
on the hill in the wilderness
mm-hmm.
and its representation of we have beaten the Depression.
Yes.
Doesn't turn out in the way that everyone had hoped.
No.
Could we read a little bit more from they opened Sawbill Lodge in 1935?
Sure. The Argo Bust opened Sawbill Lodge in 1935 to minimal success. They sent 100 postcards a day to Minneapolis businessmen whose addresses they got through George's brother's advertising agency. Not all of the businessmen came, but some did. The guests liked to sit in front of the fireplaces in the evenings, and sometimes the Argo Bus would join them for a game of chess or checkers. It seemed promising. But contrary to all of my hopes and expectations, the Argo Bus stay didn't last long. When 1941 came around and the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, the stint at Sawbill was over. The Argo Bus tried to keep the lodge open that summer, but it was harder to get supplies, and with gas rationing, fewer and fewer guests arrived. All the boys but Wilson joined the services, one in the Navy, two in the Air Corps. Even the daughter left to join the Women's Army Corps. By the time the war ended, the Argo Bus children had started lives elsewhere and never returned. We were all scattered, and there was no home to go back to, Jane, the youngest Argo Bust, later wrote. After 1942, Jean left Sawbill, too. She returned to Chicago and took a job as chief dietitian for U.S. Airways. George left for Duluth. The divorce came later.
But there's a bit of happiness with Jean returning.
Yes. In fact, only Jean returned, as if the land had imprinted itself in her, forcing her to dream of birch and pine. The lodge pulled her back. After the war ended, she returned to the dirt road and the two fireplaces and the cabins with their sanded jack pine beams. She reinstated the lease and contacted old clients. Jane, the youngest Argo Bust, stopped by every once in a while to say hello and help out. But in the end, only Jean lived the rest of her life in the area. She was the only one to die there, the only one to stay. Thus, it is Jean's story, and even more my own family story, that I must turn to as a young adult in Nebraska and later upstate New York when trying to understand my longing for Sawbill, my love of the place, and my desire for the location in moments of upheaval and change to serve as a touchstone for family, for life.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's continue our story with memoirist Jennifer Case about her book, Sawbill, A Search for Place.
Run. Your baby will run. You will run.
And your story's been threaded up through mm-hmm. this to some degree, but your story really takes off
yes.
here. So tell us then, Jean comes back. What happens to the lodge?
Well, Jean ran it in the 40s, and then she ended up having to give it up. She was getting old at
right,
that point and couldn't
right.
run it anymore. So she sold it. And at some point then, my grandparents bought the resort, thinking that this would be a good investment for them to run this resort. And it was still on Sawbill Lake when they purchased it, and they tried to get it up and running
right.
as well.
So tell us about your grandparents a little bit. Why did they decide to purchase a resort?
I don't know.
You need to ask Grandma.
As a family, we had traveled to northern Minnesota on fishing trips for a number of years. Loved the North Shore area and Gunflint Trail. During those years, we had looked at various resorts for sale. We happened to travel the Sawbill Trail on one trip and met Jean Rakin at Sawbill Lodge. We loved the place. Cabins were spread out for privacy. Lodge was awesome. So we worked out a purchase with Jean, hoping to make it a permanent place to live.
They decide to do a Argobus.
Yeah, they decide that this sounds like a neat opportunity to run this resort. And I mean, it's a beautiful part of the country. So anyone who hasn't been up in northeastern Minnesota should go. It's easy to understand why someone would want to make a living in that part of the country. And I think, you know, they'd been up in that area before vacationing and things like that. And they decided it'd be worth the investment to try and run this resort.
Could we read a little bit from the email from Grandma?
Yeah.
We purchased the lodge in 1972, I think.
My grandma writes.
And we let it go back to the original owner around 1976. We would have kept it, but the Forest Service would not let me know if they would renew the lease, which would have expired in a few years. Also, they wanted the one cabin we had winterized as a ranger station, so they really didn't want the resort there.
My grandma's paragraphs are thick with text. I imagine her at her computer, typing with quick fingers, occasionally pausing to press at her lower back.
The lodge itself was huge. You could almost stand up in the fireplaces. We had the dining room, lounge, kitchen, office, employee room, and reception office in it. There were no phones. Since we were 25 miles in from Lake Superior, we had to go to Tofty nearly every day for supplies. The businesses we purchased from would leave the supplies in a shed that was by the store there. We would take turns with the outfitters on trips down to the shore. In 1957, Frank and Mary Alice Hansen had been going to the lodge for Sawbill for years, took over the outfitting from Jean Rakin. That was too bad for the lodge in a way, as the outfitting was the moneymaker there. They moved the outfitting from the lodge area closer to the boat landing on Sawbill Lake.
In the same paragraph, my grandma offers her explanation for the loss of the lodge.
We made our payments all the time we were there and also paid the real estate taxes while we had it. However, Jane did not pay the past taxes on it, which she was supposed to do according to the agreement we had. So anyway, we let it go back to her. I think another couple did take it over, but eventually it went back to its natural state. And in 1983 or 84, Solbakken Resort in Lucerne purchased the lodge at an auction and moved it log by log to their place on Lake Superior. Also, your dad might be able to give you some stories of the resort. He and Lori spent the summers there with me. Mark worked there in the summer, too. We always had to watch out for bears. Mark shot one not very far from the lodge. He had the fur in a rug for a long time. I don't know what he ever did with it, though. One time a bear got through the window in the kitchen and got its head caught in the hole where we kept the garbage can that we used when we cleared the dishes. Also, a moose went through the lodge roof one winter. These two things didn't happen when we had the resort, though.
Just like the Argobus,
mm-hmm.
your grandparents have this dream,
yes.
I think. They buy the lodge.
Yes.
They fight with the Forest Service.
Yes.
They work incredible hours,
mm-hmm.
5 in the morning till 12
yeah.
at night, and probably 4 hours a night, you
yeah.
say your grandma's sleeping, and then they give it up. And grandma, she hasn't been back too much, right?
No.
And granddad either.
I mean, there is that idea with the Argo bus going up to build the resort, with my grandparents buying the resort, that it's going to become this dream, this utopia, the sign of success, and they will keep working and working and working, but they'll be happy there. And then when maybe it's not that way, it does take a lot of work, and that the amount of work conflicts with the ideal we sometimes have of what it's like to run these sorts of businesses. And I wanted the ideal. I was searching for that ideal.
Like, Jean, you want to come back?
Yes.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Jennifer Case, author of Sawbill, A Search for Place. We'll be back in a moment. This is Arts and Letters. Let's continue our discussion with Jennifer Case about her memoir, Sawbill, A Search for Place. So you make a decision at a certain point that you are going to return.
Yes.
And maybe not stay, but who knows? Mm-hmm. Who knows? Although you're newly married, right? Mm-hmm. And you're also pregnant.
Yes.
Give us the trajectory of this return, mm-hmm. because you actually returned in a different way than I imagined you would.
So it was the summer of 2012, and I was pregnant, so I was just ending the first trimester when I ended up taking this trip, and I left Kevin in upstate New York, and I flew back to Minnesota, visited my parents. This was their final summer in Minnesota, visited them for a bit, and then we actually drove south to Missouri to visit my grandparents for a little bit, and then went back to Minnesota. And then I left my family in Mankato, where I had grown up, and drove up to Duluth, and then to Lutzen and Grand Marais.
And this moment comes about because your mom and your dad are selling your childhood home.
Yes, they're selling my childhood home. So they are about to move to Florida. They're leaving. And once my parents are out of Minnesota, I don't know when I'll have a reason really to go back to the state. So it's now or never. I'm either going to visit the resort now, or who knows when I'll have the opportunity to do that again. In the spring of 2012, I find out that I'm pregnant and that I've earned a grant to conduct research back on the North Shore. The funds will allow me to visit the building that once housed the lodge, now renovated and moved to a new site, as well as the county's local historical society. I am thrilled with both. All winter, as Kevin and I discussed starting a family, I'd thought about returning to the North Shore. I needed to, I realized, in order to wrap up loose ends and come to terms with my infatuation. Like an odd gnawing, an itch on the underside of my foot, I recognized that something had to be done. It wasn't a choice.
Mile after mile, hill after hill, keep on riding.
It wasn't a choice. Where do you decide to go first? This is after you visit your mom and dad,
yep,
and then after you visit your grandparents.
I go to Sobacan, so a Sobacan resort, which had the structure of Sawbill Lodge. That was the first stop that I made.
You had said that, you know, the lodge piece by piece was mm-hmm. moved, and you allude to it in that section. Where was it moved?
It used to be 25 miles west of Lake Superior. Now it's right on the shore of mm-hmm. Lake Superior. So Bakken Resort owns the building now, and it's part of their property.
And they piece by piece, took it in, although there's this wonderful story about an accident where some of the logs are damaged. So they had to, it's not completely what it was, but it's close, right?
And they actually had to add more logs because the Argo bus, when they built it, they ran out of logs and they were too tired to go get more. And so it's actually a log short of where it was. So it was low. It was a low building. Oh. And when the Sobakan Resort bought it, they added those logs back to bring it to code.
Blue skies, white clouds, sunshine all around.
Sobakan Resort, which dismantled, reassembled, and then renovated Sawbill's original lodge, surprises me. I had assumed the resort would be hidden, tucked up in a hill or down a dirt road close to the shore, rustic and secluded like the old Sawbill Lodge. Instead, it sits 50 feet off the highway, hardly hidden in the trees. A single blue marker, rectangular and insignificant, announces the upcoming entrance. I must have driven past Sobakan many times before without noticing, without realizing what it was.
Big waves knock me down.
The lodge itself is squat, one of the L-shaped sides reaching towards the road, the other jutting to the right. The dark brown logs make it blend in with the trees, which crouch in on all sides. A string of eight or so motel rooms reach to the left of the building. Two motorcycles are parked in front of one unit, a van with a canoe in front of another. A woman leans up against a rusted car near the motel room farthest to the left and smokes a cigarette. She eyes me as I park near the lodge, and I wonder if she works here, if she's one of the owners, or if she's just visiting, like me.
When the sun comes up, peek out at the morning glories. It's so fun, 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 in the summertime. It's so fun.
I follow the signs to the check-in desk, situated in the middle of the L. I pay the rest of my bill, receive the key to the telemark suite, and am directed to park near the back of the lodge. A thin gravel road circles the building. Rain has eroded sections of the road, and I bump and jiggle past the resort's lakeside cabins. The trees whisper in the wind. My feet sink into the damp gravel, coated with a thin layer of pine needles. I wheel my luggage along the plank path behind the lodge building and unlock my door. I've made it. I drop my luggage and backpack on top of the small dining table to my left, next to the fireplace. On the other side of the room, a couch faces a coffee table. The back wall comprises the kitchenette with a refrigerator, oven, microwave, and sink. Various mismatched utensils hang from pegs above the stove, and wire shelving above the sink holds similarly mismatched plates, cups, and bowls. A wire basket beneath the sink contains an assortment of rags and hand towels, along with a half-empty bottle of dish soap. Behind the kitchenette's wall is the bedroom, containing the queen bed with its green quilted comforter, a small desk, and two end tables. A plank shelf above the bed holds extra pillows and blankets. The room lacks windows and a door, not really a room of its own, but a cool breeze makes its way from the living room, carrying with it the sound of waves crashing against the shore some 200 feet away. I am here.
So, wow. it's obvious how mm-hmm. important that moment was because yeah. you're more descriptive here mm-hmm. about the littlest things mm-hmm. than you are anywhere else. Mm-hmm. That must have been unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, I'd spent years and years at this dreaming point obsessing over this place and dreaming about it. And then suddenly it's real in a very physical way. And there are these utensils hanging from pegs in the kitchenette.
So it had a feel for what you wanted.
Yeah, it had a feel for what I wanted. But it also, and I remember this, it wasn't something I knew, right? This is all very new to me and it wasn't familiar to me. The building itself wasn't familiar to me. And I remember that. Contrast the difference between the fact that I'd been dreaming up the space for so long and then suddenly getting there and realizing that what I'd been dreaming was always just a dream, not the actual resort. I try to imagine my grandparents in this room playing cribbage on a quiet day or cleaning up after the guests. I try to imagine my dad and his siblings putting together a puzzle in the corner. Their presence haunts me, not because I can sense them lurking in the shadows, my grandmother with a dust rag and my dad with a book, but because I know I am placing them here. I have dragged some sort of spirit into this room.
So then you decide, all right, I'm actually going to go back to the original mm-hmm. Sawbill mm-hmm. locale, mm-hmm. which is no longer there. What were you hoping to see?
I was hoping to recognize something or just feel some sort of resonant recognition, to stand there and just know that I was in the right spot and that this is where it is, to sense that history in the ground that I was standing on.
And you say that, you know, you drive with anticipation. Mm-hmm. You keep moving forward.
Yes.
You need to see Sawbill. I need to see what it is. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
I needed to see what was real rather than what I was envisioning in my head, what I was imagining. I needed that very physical view.
Flying feels more like I'm falling, and no one is there to catch me. No one is there to catch me.
Once I reach the lake, I pull into a parking lot much larger than I had remembered. Half the size of a football field, the lot teems with cars, trucks, SUVs, and empty canoe trailers. Dust coats their undersides, pollen flecks their windshields. Surely the parking lot has been renovated, I think. This isn't the parking lot I remember from when I was 10. I stall in the middle of an aisle before parking. I wonder if I'm in the right place.
Trying to reach for the ground, but the harder I try, the more weightless I become.
A gust of wind advances like a truck through the trees, filling the air with a mechanical roar. I stand up, pack my bag, and stretch my back. I walk to the fork in the path where the deer had stood and turn right, further into the forest. The lodge, I know, was south and west of the outfitters and the boat launch. I walk slowly and search for crumbled rock. I want evidence, proof, some sort of gravestone. I meander around the lake, then away from it. Tree roots emerge like gnarled knuckles from the dirt. I step over them, careful not to trip. My boots sink into pine needles and birch leaves. Spiders spin webs from the damp limbs of trees. I find nothing. Where is the grassy plain that the Argo bus saw when they first traveled here? Where are the molding carcasses of cabins that I swear I saw as a 10-year-old when we came here with my dad? Where are the artifacts, the fireplace pits, and the rusted nails in the crumbling concrete? I enter a small clearing, mowed down to create a turnaround for cars and trucks. Halfway down the grassy lane, a few empty campsites shoot off, marked by numbered pillars. Maybe the lodge stood here, and that's why there are no trees, why it's so easy to keep this part groomed. But I don't have a mental map of this area. I have no idea where the cabin stood in relation to the fishing pier and the creek and the boat launch. I have no idea how far the lodge was erected from the shore. Useless, this trek without preparation. I need someone like my father to show me around. I turn back toward the fishing pier. Again, I study the ground for the residue of buildings, for any clue that my family once walked these paths. I search slowly, methodically, but I don't expect much. Useless, I think again. How silly of me to have come, expecting the lodge to emerge. I return to the boat launch and up a groomed path to Sawbill Outfitters. A bell above the door rings as I step in. I want to ask someone if they know where the lodge once stood, where in relation to these buildings, this road. But the two college-age employees lean over the counter playing cribbage. They probably aren't even from this area, I think. I feign interest in the plastic packages of trail mix and screen-printed t-shirts. I do not stay long.
But whenever I'm flying, feels more like I'm falling, and no one is there to catch me. Something is wrong.
Back in the car, on the way down the Sawbill Trail toward Tofty, I drive slower than on the way up. 35 miles per hour now, instead of 50. A black, weasel-like animal runs across the road, too quick for me to tell if it's a muskrat or a mink. I wonder what has happened to all the yellow butterflies. The road is bare, no roadkill even to show where they once clustered. As I near the lake, a fog rolls up the hills. I pull to the side of the road near a slight overlook. Fog obscures the valley here, thinning each layer of trees so that the hill in front of me materializes as if painted in five distinct shades of green. A very light green at the bottom, three increasingly darker stripes, and a deep hunter green at the top. Hawks circle in the distance. A mist chills my face and hands.
It's sad in some ways. I think you were very happy you went.
Yes.
But it was hard.
It was a letting go.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's not what you had hoped, but you knew it wasn't going to be.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it could have been more.
Yeah. I mean, it was a kind of a sad acceptance, I guess. Maybe I would just never have all the answers I had once wanted to have.
So you don't just drive away.
No.
You go back to the Sabaukin.
Yeah, and I go back to the lodge and back to the shore, which felt very familiar to me, the rocks and the water. And then I was just sitting there trying to process things and think about what I had seen and what I hadn't seen and how I felt.
Morning dove and the crazy loon. So much fun in early June. Wake me up to start our trek. But I haven't had my coffee yet.
These memories shape me. And so I see myself in the trees and the roads, the mist on the shore, the lake water lapping against purple and red boulders, blackened with cold. I love who I am here, in my sandals and cap, my gray fleece that has somehow picked up an orange stain on the sleeve, my blue socks that are bleached on the soles. I am cool air in quilts, the smell of pine needles dampened by rain and by mist. I am the daughter who remembers stopping in a parking lot with her father, a man in a brown ranger's hat, a hand shading his eyes. A man who willingly traded his work suits for leather hiking sandals, zip-off hiking pants, and old t-shirts. A man who stared into the darkness, into the fire pit, into the sky and the lake and the fog, and was happy there.
Up and gone like a sad, sad song. Perfect day.
Were you able to gain what you had hoped?
I didn't gain what I had hoped, but I gained something. And that was an acceptance for the complexities of my relationship with place and the ability to honor what this place meant for me without feeling like I was pulled back to it and could no longer engage with the places where I was actually living.
view at the top is a beautiful sight. The stars are shining so bright tonight.
Was there a moment where you were thinking maybe you would go there to live?
Oh, yes. And I wanted that to be the end of the story and to be able to return. And, you know, even now I think if I had the opportunity to make a life in this part of the country, I probably would.
Morning dove and the crazy loon. Summer fun is gone too soon.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musician Bakir Salam for his song, Weightless.
But whenever I'm flying, feels more like I'm falling, and no one is there to catch me.
Thank you to musicians and songwriters Tim Anthony, Bakir Salam, Sabor Salam, and Braden Miller for the cool jazz. Thank you to musician Michael Shackelford. A special thanks to musician Charlotte Taylor, accompanied by Matt Stone, for her beautiful songs inspired by the memoir.
Morning dove and the crazy loon. Summer fun is gone too soon.
A special thanks to Grandma, Ellen Case. Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for mastering the program. Thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt for the story editing advice. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Thank you to the Four Points by Sheridan Little Rock Midtown for providing accommodations to guests on Arts and Letters. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to Jennifer Case for her memoir and her quest to converse with the ghosts of a place's past, and to be able to say, this is the place, this is where I belong, this is home. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Gertrude Stein. This is the place of places, and it is here.